Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save big money
at Menards. We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 168. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Paul Zimmerman. Today we discuss Paul's recent trip to Iraq and his experiences doing drone photogrammetry while he was there. Let's get to it. All right, welcome to the show, everyone. Paul, welcome to this hemisphere.
Hey, thank you. How you doing?
good. Yeah, I'll start with where I'm at because we always say that, but that's a really quick one. Then we're going to talk about where you've been because we've been leading up to it for the last month or so. But we're back in North Carolina like we were the same time last year, and we're here until beginning of January where we spend, because of, I don't know, I wouldn't call it poor planning. It's kind of fun, but we have basically 5 days from the time we're done here to get to basically California again, Lake Havasu City, Arizona, which is on the border of California, Arizona, for an event we're going to. So that should be fun. One direction across the country and right back across the other as fast as we can go. So,
oh boy.
That's what we're doing. So
coffee fueled, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But you just got back this week from Iraq. We've been talking about that last few episodes that we had you on, and we want to hear all about it. So let's just maybe set it up with the project that you were on, and then talk about what you did there.
All right. So the project I was on was it's part of the Lagash Archaeological Project, which is out of the University of Pennsylvania. The head of the project is Dr. Holly Pittman. She was one of my professors when I was there. She was also my wife's dissertation advisor.
Nice.
Art historian, worked all over Mesopotamia, Turkey, and Iran, and Iraq, Syria too, most likely, though I can't remember what project she may have worked on there. Anyhow, so art historian, but with a lot of field work experience under her belt. And a month and a half or so ago, 2 months maybe, she was visiting a professor, Edward Oxenschlager, who was one of the principals on the project at the site called Lagash, which is in the south of Iraq in Digar Governorate. Mm-hmm. That project ran from 1968 to 1990. I know Professor Oxenschlager from my time in Yemen, because he was one of the principals on the project that I worked on there as a young grad student in 1994 and 1995. He lives half an hour from me up here in the country, so I visit him every now and then. Anyhow, so Dr. Pittman was visiting Dr. Oxenschlager and talking about this upcoming project. They wanted to do a very short season, just a couple weeks. And one of the parts of it was going to be doing some drone mapping. They wanted to get a new contour plan of the major site of Lagash, as well as some other drone mapping on various other sites in the area. And so she was talking to him, who could we get to do this? And he said, well, you know, Paul recently quit his job at Dalton, and he's pretty good with tech, we know. So why don't you call him? And she called me, and wow, I've been waiting 30 years to get to Iraq, and I finally got the chance, and it did not disappoint. It was so much fun.
Nice, nice. Well, let's, for those that, you know, are in the United States anyway, and here Iraq, they might think conflict, CNN, all that kinds of stuff. What was your experiences just getting to Iraq and then getting around in Iraq when you were there?
Right. So Iraq has been more or less open to Americans for a few years now. I know a number of archaeologists have been working in the north in what's Iraqi Kurdistan, but in the south, where the major Mesopotamian sites that you've heard of are all located, it's been Italian, British, French projects primarily, but not so many U.S.-based projects. So this project, the Lagash Archaeological Project, had a season in 2019. Mm-hmm. But what's happened is that Dr. Pittman now has the permit for Lagash, which is a major site in third millennium BC, Mesopotamia, a Sumerian site with a major city-state in the early dynastic period of the middle third millennium BCE, and also major presence in the late third millennium BCE in what's called the Neo-Sumerian period. So anyhow, that just background here, Americans have been working, including some that are on this project in various sites in the South, but not to the level that other people from other parts of the world have. But fortunately, we've got this permit. And so I flew from New York to Istanbul with a connecting flight to Basra. And then we got a ride from Basra up to Shatra and to Lagash, so a couple hours away. And it's been interesting. As we were driving up, I have no sense of any kind of personal danger, right?
Okay.
I did not feel threatened in any way whatsoever. However, the authorities were extremely concerned about having Americans there, not in a bad way, in a good way, in that they wanted to make sure that we'd be safe. And so what that meant practically, now this project, this season is just a tiny little skeleton crew. There were four of us on the project.
Okay.
The main part of the project was a grad student, one of Dr. Pittman's advisees, Reed Goodman. He was doing soil cores for his dissertation. There was my side project of doing these maps, and there were two other people. One is Philip Florin, who is he's a Romanian, not an archaeologist, but a geographer, soil scientist. And he was brought along to help Reed doing the drilling. And Zeta Rawi, who's an Iraqi living in America and is the project's, he's also a PhD archaeologist himself, but he's the project's facilitator, go-to guy, handles the paperwork, handles the rentals and that sort of stuff. Yeah, so it was just the four of us. But despite being the four of us living in a farmhouse right next to the site.
Yeah.
Little village, totally safe, no problem. Everybody knows us. We had two different dispatches of police keeping us safe. So we had two big tents outside the dig house, one full of antiquities police and one full of police from Digar government. On our drive up from Basra, word came out that we were coming through, so we ended up, being guests of the police at Nasiriyah. So we're in the police station there, being interviewed, talking to them. I interviewed in the local paper.
Wow.
There was a lot of hubbub about a very small project. And then the whole time that we were there, we had police with us all the time. I actually found it a little problematic, not because of anything that they were doing particularly, but because they were so afraid for our safety that even though the site itself was 15-20 second walk from the house, I mean, literally it was one house between ours and the site, I couldn't go up onto the tell without a police escort.
Jeez.
So,
wow.
I felt no kind of unsafeness about it, though. We were watching the news happening in Baghdad with an eye toward our own safety, because there was that drone attack against the prime minister, and there were protests, and apparently there were some protests also in the south where we were, though I didn't see or any of it firsthand, but I'd heard about it. What can I say? I felt no personal threat, but it was underlying the whole time that we were there.
Well, that's good. I just wanted to get that out of the way because, you hear about some of these places and people just get afraid of doing anything there because of, a lot of media hype. I mean, there's still some dangerous areas and things going on, I'm sure, but there is a lot of lumping the entire country into one state of being when it's just not that case. So,
yeah. And what I've always found, I found this in Yemen as well, when I was doing my dissertation research, is that there's a real marked difference in the way that people treat you if you are a faceless representative of some foreign government, right? Versus if you're a scientist working there, living with the people that you're working with the locals, trying your best to speak their language, hanging out with them, joking with them, whatever.
Yeah.
The personalization of that kind of interaction defrays so much of the threat, or at least my perception of the threat is defrayed so much by it. You know, that's not to say that there might not be somebody that has a real grudge against an American hearing that we're there and coming through and causing trouble. But yeah. In all my years of field work, I've never experienced anything like that.
Okay. Well, good to know. So in the last part of this segment, let's talk about why you guys were there. What was the reason behind the project? We'll get to what you did and some of the actual activities you guys did and maybe mm-hmm. some of your findings later on in the show. But what was the reason you guys were there? What was the question you're trying to answer or the data you were trying to collect?
Right. So the main part of the project was Reed's core samples.
Yeah.
So he was trying to get down through a few thousand years of sediments accumulated in southern Iraq to try to find out what was happening to the coastline there. There is a theory that was not widely supported when I was a grad student, but seems to have certainly gained traction, that the coastline of the Persian Gulf or Arabian Gulf, depending who's doing the map. So the coastline of the Gulf has moved southward over time. So if you think of like the way that the Mississippi Delta has been pushing out into the Gulf of Mexico, mm-hmm. same sort of thing. The Tigris and the Euphrates have over the millennia pushed the coastline farther and farther out. So these very old cities, Mesopotamian cities like Ur and like Uruk, and even Lagash, which is farther north than those two, which is one that we're at, didn't used to be miles and miles and miles inland, but used to be kind of in a semi-coastal environment at the time of their heights, right? Mm-hmm. Ur has probably two harbors on it. So it's likely that they were in a kind of marshy environment. Right now you go to Ur and it's just flat and very desolate around there and dry and, you know, dead land. But at the time that people were living there, probably was not like that. So anyhow, so Reed's project, which was the crux of what we were doing, is trying to get a number of soil cores to find out about what the changes were and when especially the changes were.
Okay.
On the coastline in that area, you know, was it a marine environment? Was it marsh? Was it tidal kind of coming and going? Was this a trend that was unitary in one direction through time, or were there times that it kind of ebbed and flowed? So that's what he was trying to get at. And I was just brought along for the ride because they need maps, because they want to start doing some serious excavation next year. So I might be going back in the spring, fingers crossed. Yeah. You know, at Lagash, and they wanted to get a new map, and they wanted to test out the drone mapping, and they wanted to do, you know, all of the above. So yeah, I was there in a supporting role.
Huh. Okay. Well, I think before we really get into it and have to get cut off here, let's just take a break right now and come back on the other side and talk about mm-hmm. exactly what you guys did and how that all went. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code Archaeotech. That's ARCHAEOTECH.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 168. Droning on with Paul. That's what we're calling this.
Droning on and on and on. I'm good at that.
That's right. That's right. Me too. Hey, that's what, you know, podcasters are inherently good at that, I think. So, All right. So I love how all this came together for you, actually, because you started getting into drone flying not that long ago, really, and upgrading your equipment, getting some real stuff. And then you recently went and got your drone license. I think that you were planning on doing that, but you were probably pushed a little quicker than usual, maybe because of this project. So you wanted to maybe get some credentials, I would assume. But given all that, it's really awesome that you got to use those skills out in this environment. So let's talk about, since this is the Archaeotech Podcast, how did you prepare to go out there? We talked about you getting ready to prepare to think about all this stuff a few episodes back when we first announced this, but for how did it go getting your drone over there and the supplies that you brought, and did all your planning end up being, you know, we're going to talk about this throughout the whole segment, but basically did all your planning end up being too much or not enough is what I want to know from a supply standpoint. So let's start at the beginning.
All right. So when I was first brought on the project, I understood that I'd be using a DJI Phantom 4 Pro.
Yeah.
Right. Very similar to the 3 standard that I have, but with improved everything. So I basically knew what to expect in terms of the software and the hardware that I'd be using. So I wasn't worried about that. As it developed, it turned out that we were going to be using for the mapping and the processing of the maps, we were going to be using a product called Drone Deploy.
Okay.
Okay. So I can learn how to use Drone Deploy. No real problem. I looked at, we had Kyle Olson on a couple of years ago on this podcast talking about an article that he co-wrote explaining, you know, what they were doing with drones, basically experimenting with different elevations, different speeds, and so on. So I reread that and I discussed the matter with Reed. And as we started going forward, we realized that there was a serious problem, which is that the drone that they had was the Pro Plus. Now, the Pro Plus has a controller that has a built-in display unit, right? So it's basically an Android tablet built into it.
Yeah.
We can't run the Drone Deploy software on that directly. And there were some other problems, too. So what they did is they purchased a brand new drone to take out. And this one was the DJI Phantom 4 RTK. Which has a fancy GPS, well, satellite positioning system nubbin on the top of it that gets GPS, GLONASS, Galileo, and Beidou. So it gets 4 different satellite systems. So it can be very precise because, you know, it measures one against the other. And they purchased it actually through Anatom.
Oh, nice. Right? So, yeah.
That was on my recommendation. They had some questions on GPS. And so it ties it back to this podcast. And they also got it with what's the DJI DRTK2 mobile station, which is a base station. So in conjunction, and it also gets those same 4 bands. So in conjunction of these two, using the DJI software, you can get a positional fix for the drone of, let's see, I was typically getting 1.25 centimeters in northing and easting and about 2 centimeters in elevation.
Jeez. <That's pretty
laughs> without great. Having to d- sign up for anything else. Just go and plop the base station out in the field somewhere and then fly within like a kilometer and a half of it so that they could it could use this correction signal.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. So I had no experience with the system at all. So could not prepare for it. Drone deploy. Well, this particular drone also has a built-in display unit, so you can't run drone deploy directly on it. Drone deploy, fortunately, they do have a white paper. They've got a webpage that explains how you can use the built-in mapping software with DJI's built-in mapping software, export it to drone deploy for the processing and certain settings so that it keys it into what drone deploy is going to expect. Go ahead.
Well, just pause there for a second, because I'm curious, this Pro Plus or the RTK, it sounds like they're like, you know, slightly more advanced versions of maybe the lower version that they'd have of the Phantom 4. Mm-hmm. And yet you can't, because of the screen, you can't put your own applications on there. That seems like a serious limitation to me. But it sounds like they also really beefed up their ability to control the drone in a coordinated way like drone deploy would do. Is that the case?
Yeah, that is exactly the case. Now, probably, because these are Androids, there probably is a way to sideload the drone deploy software onto it. But I didn't find any good description of how to do that. And I wasn't about to tinker with that because I had another workflow that was supported by drone deploy. But what I end up doing, the drone deploy software, it's all web-based and it's very intuitive, very easy to use. So I drew all my plans, you know, the flight plans in drone deploy on the web. And then I found out how to web scrape. Well, found out I tinkered with it a little bit. So I'd web scrape the plan that would be displayed on my screen. I wrote a little Python script to process the JSON that had all the coordinates and then turn that into a KML file that I could then upload onto the controller. And then I tweak all the other parameters to match what was in drone deploy, because drone deploy had their own set of recommendations for like horizontal and vertical overlap on the images and the elevation that you're flying at and the speed that you're flying at and all that stuff. So basically, you know, you can do all that mapping on the screen on the controller, but it's not quite responsive. It pissed me off. But doing it in drone deploy was great. And then with the script I wrote, I could then do it there, transfer it onto the controller, and then tweak all the other parameters until I got them the same as what was in drone deploy. And that worked fairly well for me in the end.
Okay.
But it was a little kludgy. And also there was this RTK, and the documentation for it from DJI is really not good. It's really awful. Not least of which, we didn't know whether or not we needed to have a 4G dongle in it for connecting it to cell signal, right?
Okay.
And if you flip through the instruction manual, the owner's manual that came with it, there's no mention of the dongle, though there's a slot for the dongle in the mobile station, mm-hmm. except for in the Chinese language one. And I don't read Chinese. There they had in the parts list, they had an optional 4G dongle, but it wasn't in the English or the French or the Italian or any of the other languages, like 20 other languages there. They didn't have that. They just had it in the Chinese. So I didn't know if this was necessary. There was no mention of it. It turns out it wasn't necessary. It was a little confusing. So I had a day of just sitting down trying to figure out how all these parts work together because it was not well documented, but it wasn't hard. And once I figured it out, it worked really well. The biggest problem we had was when we got to Basra Airport, you know, here we had this big fancy drone and this big fancy GPS base station. And as is wont to happen when you're in what used to be a very controlled police state, somebody at the airport said, they didn't want to get in trouble for letting us in. And instantly it got confiscated by the Mahabharat, the secret police. We got it back a day and a half later, 2 days later.
Yeah.
because it was an embarrassment on their part because we'd done everything properly. They actually were supposed to have known about it. And this is part of the reason why we ended up going to the police station and everything on the way back.
Gotcha.
And why the police were so interested in protecting us was because there was this initial like overstepping of bounds. You know, it was CYA on somebody's part, but it was a bit of a political embarrassment because everything was done properly and somebody was afraid that maybe it hadn't been done properly. So, you know, amends had to be made. And they were. We got the equipment back in time for me to work with it and in time for me to write a script and figure out how all the pieces worked and then fly everything. And geez, you know, I used to do total station surveying and the site of Lagash is over 500 hectares in size. It is humongous.
Yeah.
So to do a site that size with the total station would have taken me over a month to do. Sure. And it would have taken two people because it's a two-person team, one to run the total station and one to move the prism. And instead, I did it in about 4.5 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had 8 batteries. So I would take out 4 batteries at a time, 1 battery in the base station and 1 battery in the controller. And mm-hmm. I'd fly for about 2 hours and then the base station and the controller would be down below half. And I would have used up the 4 batteries for the drone. I'd come in, we'd have lunch and I'd go back out and do the other 4 batteries while I charged the first 4 batteries up and nice. Cycled the other batteries through. So it worked really nicely as a workflow, you know, 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon. And then in the meantime, I'd go and, you know, lend a hand at the, with the drilling. So you know, it worked okay. The biggest problem that we had was because Drone Deploy is entirely web-based, I didn't have any trouble generating the maps, but at the end, you have to upload all your images and thousands mm-hmm. of images that I'd have to upload to the site, and it Jeez. Just wouldn't work. So I'm in the process of uploading images right now, and I've been extremely pleased with the results I've been getting.
Cool. That's awesome. That's really neat. And I'm glad the batteries worked out that way too. The batteries is always kind of the thing you're, you know, most concerned about, especially, I mean, you can kind of guess at what the weather's going to be like by looking at weather forecasting. I don't know how weather forecasting in Iraq is, but, you know, you can kind of get an idea of how windy it's going to be because obviously windier conditions will take your batteries down a lot quicker.
Yeah, yeah.
As the drone tries to stabilize. How was that, the weather?
So for the most part, it was hot and fairly still. There were 2 days that I had wind issues. I can talk about one of them a little later, but for the most part, I was okay with that. Mm-hmm. The first week was up in the mid-90s to 100. So it was really warm standing out there in the sun.
I bet.
But yeah, weather wasn't really the problem. And the batteries, fortunately, we were able to keep them charged nicely, even though the power mm-hmm. would go out most days. Usually at the most inopportune time. But it was that internet upload that's what really bit me because I wasn't able to test as I went, right? I wasn't able to take, you know, the few hundred shots that I took, you know, on the last transect and upload them to see if they're any good during mm-hmm. that lunch break because there was no way they were going to get uploaded. So I have noticed a few problems caused by the RTK, some elevation problems. So I think I'm going to have to break down rather than have the software, the Drone Deploy software, map the entirety of the site all at once. I think I have to break it down session by session, then correct for elevation and stitch them back together, which is fine because that's too big of a site to do the contour plans at full resolution anyhow, because then you'd have lots of squiggly little lines that don't mean anything. We want something smoother. So I'm going to have to downsample it after I stitch it together. So, you know, I'm not bothered by that, but it does mean a little bit of extra work on the back end here.
So back to the images real quick. I was thinking about that. I wasn't really putting together what you were saying until you just made the last comment about the images. You had to upload all this to a website to actually see the images. They weren't just being stored on an SD card that you could toss into your computer and take a look at them to get an idea of what they're looking like.
Oh, no. They definitely, they're being stored on the SD card on the drone, just like anything else. And so then I'd copy them off to a hard drive. So I had an extra copy.
Gotcha.
But you have to upload a lot of them up to the drone deploy site in order for their software to be able to put it together to make the, to do the photogrammetry. And this is something that actually I was really pleased with. Actually, why don't we, it's 15 minutes now. Why don't we go to break and I can talk about some of the mechanics of processing and how pleased I was with it, and I'd tell you a bit of the side projects I did, which are kind of cool.
Sounds good. Back in a minute.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See home club for details.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right. Welcome to the last segment of the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 168. And Paul, right at the end of the last segment, you were getting ready to tell us about some of the processing and things like that, some of the products you were getting from this. Mm-hmm. I did want to mention, I didn't get a chance on the last segment, I used Drone Deploy just to try it out when it was, when I was, had a drone that would kind of do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. My God, it was probably like 5 years ago, and I don't remember doing any sort of photogrammetry, and maybe I just wasn't using it for that at the time, but that's pretty cool that it actually does the photogrammetry, because back when I was using it, its primary function was flight planning, and that was pretty much it, you know? So that's really cool that I can do that now.
Yeah. So a lot of people are using drones for photogrammetry in archaeology. And, I read up on what a bunch of people are doing, and there's so much that's written about, you know, the particular workflow. And at the risk of sounding like an ad, maybe we ought to talk to Drone Deploy about advertising with us. At the risk of sounding like an ad, that's where this really shone for me, is that you and I are both Apple guys, right? And so, you know, Apple's always, it just works, right? That's what they, their catchphrase, or one of their catchphrases. And I don't really care too much about that for any particular company software. I don't feel any loyalty even to Apple, which I've used their products forever. But having worked in a school, that's something that really matters to me. I want stuff that's simple. Okay. Now, simple has, for a lot of tech people, has a really bad connotation, and it kind of is synonymous with dumbed down. Right.
Right.
But in my mind, good simple isn't dumbed down, but is thought out in such a way that 90% of what you're going to do, you can do out of the box with minimal extra effort. Mm-hmm. Right? If it's extra good, you can override those in certain ways, you know, because you have additional knowledge that doesn't apply to the 90%, and you have additional skill that you can improve beyond that. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, for most people, it's going to work right out of the box. And that's exactly how Drone Deploy was for me. So, you know, I've seen things where people talk about using like MetaShape or ODM, and those are very good products on their own. But you're basically, you're tied to having a good computer with a good GPU and then building in a workflow that includes pre-processing your images in order to get good output. All that I had to do was take these images and just upload them and wait a few hours and end up with a beautiful map at the end of it. I mean, it was really so simple. Nice. In a good way. Yeah, I can probably tweak it. I can, you know, I'm definitely going to have to do it for the major Lagash map. Like I said, I'm going to have to post-process that to make the elevations make sense. But it was so painless that I highly recommend people looking at it. Now, this is, you pay for the software. Right? I mean, it's not cheap. It's not free. You know, you pay for that convenience. But Wow. I'm glad that I'm not paying for it, but somebody else is, because then I get to use it and I get to reap the benefits.
Yeah. And, you know, not only that, but if you're doing this a lot, it would actually, you know, probably, but unless you're doing some really detailed stuff where you really need to manipulate every single aspect of the thing, which some people might do that, but most people probably don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. What Drone Deploy produces for them, I'm sure, is enough. But if you're doing this a lot, I mean, man, you don't have to keep up on the latest software and the latest tech and the latest, you know, speeds on your computer. Let them figure that out. All you got to do is upload it and bam, you get maps. And they're presumably keeping their equipment to an upgraded standard because they want to be able to do that as much as possible, right? So they're going to, you know, crowdsource all that computing power internally and get it done. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I really... like, again, I sound like an advertisement for them, and I guess maybe I am, but I was so, so thoroughly impressed. And that's part of the good thing about it. I could see that in building out the flight plans beforehand, you know, because I built out a few before I went to the field. I could see that it was really well-designed, well-thought-out software. So I wasn't really worried that I'd be able to get good products. Now, I just arrived. We're recording on Thursday. I arrived on Tuesday night back in the country. And yesterday, you know, took care of emails and banking and all the stuff that you have to do when you've been gone for a while. And in the meantime, I also uploaded photos that I took. One of the side projects that we did was we went to the site of Ur. Now, Ur has been on my mind for decades.
Nice.
It's the like major tourist archaeological site alongside Babylon in Iraq. And, you know, if you know nothing else, you remember from your fifth grade or sixth grade world history class, you remember something about the Ziggurat of Ur. Well, the Department of Antiquities, ESPA, they wanted a map of one of the, or a model rather, of one of the buildings right next to the ziggurat, a building called the Edubla Ma. They wanted that for conservation purposes. Okay. So I quickly planned out the flight path and however many pictures it took, 100 or 200, and gave a very good measurable 3D model that you can just, you know, spin around and take measurements on it and zoom in and zoom out and such. Really good. But I had to do that for the Department of Antiquities. But because I was on site, I was like, well, what the hell? Let me do a model of the ziggurat.
Hey, and so why not?
I woke up this morning and there was an email from Drone Deploy saying, hey, we've processed your model of the ziggurat. And I've sent Dr. Pittman an email this morning saying, oh my God, this is so sexy. We need to like publish this. She hasn't yet responded. So I'm hoping to hear from her very soon. But, and if I hear from her soon enough, I'll put in the link in the show notes. I would like to put this up on Sketchfat, but it's a brilliant freaking model of the ziggurat of Ur. And that was a lot of fun because I programmed it in. I'm like, how tall is this? I'm like, I think it's like 50 meters tall. So I programmed the thing for the drone to fly at 60 meters. And then I climbed up on top of the ziggurat and flew it from there. And it was a little close for comfort a few times, but it gave a beautiful, absolutely gorgeous model. And you know what I had to do in terms of my computer hardware and configuration and everything? Nothing. Nothing. I just programmed the flight plan and downloaded the files and uploaded them on the internet and then woke up the next day with this little treat.
Nice.
And then there's another one. Because we were there, let's see, we went there twice. So I did half a flight plan. I had some problems. The controller for that DJI drone freaks out every now and then. So twice it wouldn't turn off. Got in a kind of a brick state. So I had to like open it up and find the internal battery and disconnect that. And then it would start back up again. Let's see. And a couple of times the return to home function just stopped working on its way back. So I had to put it back into manual flight mode and fly it back home by myself. Jeez. And once when I was doing, so there's an area there called the Royal Cemetery of Ur. So if you know anything, if you remember anything from your middle school world history, Mesopotamia, you probably saw things like the Standard of Ore, the Ram in the Thicket, whatnot. Those all came from tombs that were in that area. Okay. I've been thinking about the Royal Cemetery. It was part of my, not part of, it was my master's thesis was reevaluating the architecture in the royal tombs in the royal cemetery. And what I'd realized was that the excavator had mixed contexts. And so that made dating these really problematic because people were going off of say ceramics, but they had ceramics from multiple periods because they were mixed contexts. And so I thought, well, you know, ceramics can get mixed contexts, but it's kind of hard to move a building. So I looked at it from the architecture, also me being kind of an architecture geek, that made sense to me. Anyhow, so I've been thinking about the Royal Cemetery in depth for decades, and I got to go play around in it. So I started doing a map of it, and then the controller freaked out, and you know, I had to change batteries after halfway through it, and I put in the new battery, and instead of starting at the 50% mark, it went back to the zero.
Jeez.
So I wasn't able to finish it until a week later when we went back, and then I did finish it up. Then I got that model, and it looks great.
Nice.
But yeah, so now I've got this model of the Royal Cemetery. I've got a model of the Aie du Blanc Mach, and I've got a model of the Ziggurat of Ur. So all those three at Ur, which were side projects. Only one of them was kind of on scope, but because I was able to work so quickly through the rest of this stuff, because of the tools that I had, it gave me the free time to play with that. And then also, you know, I helped read with the drilling just because, what else am I going to do if I'm not flying the drone? I might as well play in the dirt, right?
Nice. Hey, speaking of getting back to Lagash, are there standing structures there? Is there anything above ground that's still visible?
Right. So there are no ancient standing structures. On the entirety of the site, there are, let's see, there's one little guard shack from the old excavations. There's the old dig house from the old excavations. And there is a shrine.
Okay.
A mausoleum, basically, for some local saint on the site. But ancient stuff does not exist above ground. However, you can see the footprints of buildings if it rains, right? So there's been some drone work there that you can definitely see parts of buildings and such. And so we were there in the dry season, but if we go back in the spring, it'll probably rain periodically. And then the hope is that I can go and do some drone flights and get some good top-down imagery. And we can do things like look at the placement of the buildings, the streets, how they communicate. It's a very short occupation period on this site. So it gives us nice little snapshots, right?
Nice.
Many of the tell sites are built up over millennia. This one had a few hundred years that it was the biggest, strongest city in this part of Iraq, this part of Mesopotamia. And then the center of power moved somewhere else.
Okay. Nice.
So,
cool.
So we do have a way of seeing snapshots through, but not through standing architecture, just through the differential way that the soil absorbs water.
Right. Nice. That's pretty cool. That makes me think of a drone I saw. God, what was it? Probably something on Facebook, but I have a feeling it was like an Indiegogo thing or something like that, but some kind of drone that was fully waterproof. And in fact, you could change it around somehow. It was a four rotor quadcopter, but you could change it around somehow to actually change the position of the rotors and run it like literally underwater and almost like a submarine kind of thing. It was totally crazy. But anyway, that would be cool to actually take footage while it was raining, because most of these drones, you know, have exposed electrical motors, which aren't so conducive to rain. So it'll fly for a little while, but not too long. But wrapping up the tech aspect of this, do you know exactly how many pictures you guys took overall with the drone?
Or ballpark it? I should know, but I don't know how many were on Lagash. I think it was over 15,000. Just for Lagash. And the other ones, I was like the Ziggurat, I took about just shy of 900. The same goes for the Royal Cemetery and for the Aie du Blanc Mach, which is a small building, I took a couple hundred. We did another, we also mapped a topographic map of a small tell that's right next to Lagash. And I want to say I did about 300 photos over that. But that's one of the nice things of drone deploy. I don't have to tell it, like, you know, how often do I have to, it's built into its own algorithm. So I tell it how high it is and what overlap I want, and it decides when it should take the pictures. And because with this drone, with the incredible GPS, well, satellite positioning, sorry, of it. Are we allowed to use GPS generically like that? I don't know. I always do.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Because it's one of multiple systems, is the GPS system versus GLONASS and Galileo and everything else.
Well, GPS just means global positioning system. I mean, there might be one that's called that,
but it's also the name of one. It's like,
yeah,
it's like Jell-O and Kleenex.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. You're right. Don't get those two mixed up. Anyway. Whoa. Yeah. Well, I'm wondering with the volume of photographs that you took, if you were you offloading regularly from the drone SD cards? I mean, probably offloading just for data security reasons, but, or did you just bring enough cards out there that you were just, you know, swapping them out and when they get full?
Yeah. So I was offloading them every time I flew, you know, because I had either the late afternoon or lunchtime. So I offloaded them to an external drive all the time for data security. So I had at least seven copy. I ended up having to swap cards a lot because my cards kept on getting corrupted, the little micro SD cards. And at first I thought that it was a problem with the drone. But what it turned out was that I have, you know, these are micro SD cards, and so I've got to put them in a regular SD card reader. And those little adapters that convert a micro SD to a regular SD, they're just electrical. There's nothing smart about them, right? It's just wires. Yeah. So I wouldn't have expected that could cause problems. But as I was working, I realized that the ones that I did with one card, which came with one of the new micro SDs that we'd bought for the project, versus the ones that I did with the adapter card that I brought, my own personal one, my personal one was breaking them. So I think that I must have worn out something in there, and it was corrupting the cards, the micro SD cards. Figured that out, threw away mine, and just used the other one, and we were good from there on out. But because of that, I had to cycle through a bunch of cards. Next time out, I'm probably going to recommend that they have maybe four cards and we just cycle through them. I might copy things multiple places. I mean, having multiple copies of files is always a bit of a danger because then you don't know which is the current. But what I want is the hard drive, the external hard drive, to be the reference, right? Everything that gets done ends up there in one copy in a file system structure that's labeled by date and by project. So, you know, there's no confusion as to what it represents. And then the cards, we can, you know, come and go. And then we hand the cards to multiple people on their way home so that if something happens to the original or to somebody's card or whatever, we have the potential of having multiple backups.
Gotcha. Nice. Well, in the last couple of minutes here, is there anything, I mean, you may potentially be going back in the spring, so you're probably already thinking about how you would do this a little bit differently. What would you, what would you do differently? What are the, some of the big things that you would do differently? A little bit extra preparation, you know, more batteries. I mean, what would those things be?
Yeah. So it worked really well for us. So there isn't a whole lot of change structurally. I was asked, Reed asked me what kind of equipment we should get for next time. And so multiple SD cards purchased beforehand, probably like four of them, even though, you know, a 128 gigabyte SD card is probably going to be sufficient. If I've got four of them, I can copy all the data across to all four of them, replicate it, you know, four ways, give them to four different people so that when we come back home, especially if we come back on different flights, you know, it minimizes the opportunity of to lose the data. I would go with at least two hard drives. We only had one hard drive for the same reason, for data backup.
Yeah.
I would myself be in charge of making sure that the data look right on all these, right? That they're all organized in the exact same way. Mm-hmm. Because if we give it to multiple people to do it, it's going to end up in multiple different structures, which going to be confusing to somebody a couple of years down the road as to what they're looking at. You know, is this the same project as this one? I don't know. Are they the same days? Maybe. We have tons of propellers because I said, hey, if we break them, we're not going to be able to get them there. So they bought more than we'll ever go through. and the other thing, I brought my own landing pad. So I'm going to recommend that they get one for the project. Normally you wouldn't need it. And the way that the ground there dries, it kind of has a salt cap on it. So it doesn't kick up a whole lot of dust, but every now and then it does. And when it does, it kicks up a tremendous amount of dust. So having that landing pad is helpful. But in terms of, like, you know, 2 hours staring at the sky is actually quite tiring. So 2 hour sessions works, you know, and that's four batteries, which fits nicely in the backpack. And like I said, that also is basically the battery life of the battery that goes in the controller and in the mobile station. So that 2 hours, just in a lot of different respects, kind of fits nicely. So I don't think I would change anything with that. The only thing that would really, really improve my work there would be having faster internet, more reliable internet. And I don't know that that's possible. Next time we'll probably be living in the village, not in the next bigger village over, not in the sticks where we were, which might improve our internet, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
Yeah. Okay. Well, all right then. I think that probably does it for now. That was an awesome synopsis of that trip. Sounds like it was really fun and really just a great time and a great use of technology, and got some side projects done too. That's pretty cool. I can't believe you got a 3D model of the ziggurat. I got to see that. That's just amazing. That hopefully we can drop a link to that at some point and show our audience those. Yeah. So any final thoughts on this before we close it out?
No. I mean, again, it was my side of the project. Maybe we'll get Reed on to talk about the soil cores and what the technology is, because they're doing some very interesting things to get really good radiocarbon dates out of what is tough to get good radiocarbon dates out of. So, you know, he's working with scientists at Woods Hole on that. And, you know, it kind of does fit in with, you know, Archaeotech. But my part just went so smoothly, aside from, you know, getting the drone confiscated at the start. And my experience there was everything I'd hoped for. You know, I really enjoyed Iraq. The people that I worked with there were fantastic. I laughed my ass off the whole time because they have such a funny sense of humor. Always, always just teasing each other and making jokes and whatnot. So it was really a delightful experience.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks for taking us along that journey, Paul. And we will be back next time, and hopefully we can get some links on here at some point, or we'll just drop them on another show, or we'll share them in the APN feed if we get some of those links to the models. And for anybody listening to this in real time and happens to be in the United States, happy Thanksgiving. I'm going to go have some turkey.
Ooh, yeah. I got to check on mine. Is it still gray?
it might be. All right. Thanks, Paul. And thanks, everybody. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Chris. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeotech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.archpodnet.com/archaeotech. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugol.com. Support the show by becoming a member at archpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off Road and is license free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.